The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And then it can be automatically extended unless one of the parties expressed intention to terminate it or change it. And so basically that's a veto over the deal extension. And that allowed Russia to politically connect it and try to get concessions.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 18th, 2023. It was a busy weekend in the waters off of Ukraine and Russia. The Ukrainians hit for the second time the Kerch Bridge, which connects the Russian mainland with occupied Crimea. The Russians, meanwhile, announced that they are not renewing the Black Sea Grain Initiative, the complex agreement by which Ukraine has managed to export grain through the port of Odessa. To chew over what it all means, we gathered in the virtual jungle studio Dmitry Alperovich of Silverado Policy Accelerator and the Geopolitics Decanted podcast, and Mikhailo Soldatenko, a visiting researcher at the Harvard Law School and an international lawyer who has written for Lawfare about the Black Sea Grain Initiative. What do we know about what happened on the Kerch Bridge? How big a deal is it? Is it connected to the Russian withdrawal from the Grain Initiative? And what does the scotching of the Black Sea Grain Initiative mean for the Ukrainian economy? It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 18th. The Ukrainians hit the Kerch Bridge again. Dmitry, get us started. It seems like the Ukrainians have hit the Kerch Bridge once again. What do we know about the strike, how effective it was, and what exactly happened?
So one important thing to understand is that there is not really one Kerch Bridge. There is the railroad bridge, which has two rail links going over it. And then there is the automotive bridge, which also has two lanes going in each direction. And what the Ukrainians struck was the automotive bridge. We don't know exactly how they did it, although there are some reports, particularly in Ukrainian media, suggesting that this was the work of the SBU, the Ukrainian intelligence, in combination with the Ukrainian Navy, and that they were doing this using uncrewed surface vessels, effectively boat drones that are loaded with explosives that presumably they could drive towards the bridge and detonate. There's some damage to one span of the bridge where it has collapsed and another span that was severely damaged. So all automotive traffic over the bridge right now is halted. There was a temporary halt to the rail link traffic last night when the strike first occurred, but that looks to be just a precautionary measure by the Russians. And about 5 hours later, they resumed rail transport. The rail transport from a military logistical standpoint is actually key because that's how the Russians are resupplying their forces in Crimea and in Zaporizhia, occupied Zaporizhia Oblast. The automotive bridge is important for supplying Crimea for civilian needs and obviously for tourists going back and forth, Russian tourists, but it's not as important as a military objective.
Yeah. So, Mikhailo, I want to ask you about the strike for a different reason, which is that this bridge has just immense symbolic consequence to Ukrainians. Tell us a little bit about the bridge and why Ukrainians hate it so much.
Yeah, so basically the bridge was built following the illegal annexation by Russia of Crimea, and it basically connected the Crimea with the mainland Russia. And it was one of the symbols that Russia used to kind of promote and to celebrate so-called unification of Crimea with Russia. And so naturally, this was something that Ukrainian considered as an offense, a part of the whole thing of the aggression that started in 2014. And so from the symbolic view, this can be considered as breaking this so-called unification on the road of Crimea being at some point in the future back in Ukraine. And as we know, in 2022, there was a strike, and this another strike, there is a boost of morale for the Ukrainian people in this war.
Yeah, so Dmitry, my recollection is the Ukrainians never took responsibility for the first strike, although they made a number of kind of smugly ambiguous statements that sort of all but took credit for it. This time they have basically said, we did this, right?
Well, not officially, but certainly unnamed officials have been talking in Ukrainian media about some of the alleged details of the strike. So yeah, they're getting much bolder at acknowledging that they're behind some of these operations, realizing at this point that Russians don't have really a lot of options for retaliation. What else are they going to do? They've already been launching missiles and drone strikes into Kyiv and other cities in Ukraine. They've already invaded, so their options for escalation are quite limited.
It seems to me, though, if you're going to hit the bridge for its strategic importance, it's odd to hit the auto lanes, although there is trucking that goes over it, but leave the rail link. Should we assume that that was accidental, or is there some reason to be targeting the automotive transportation, but not the rail lines?
Well, we don't know for sure. This is speculation, but my suspicion is that it was easier to target the automotive bridge because it's significantly lower. The rail link bridge is quite a bit taller, and reaching it from a boat is significantly more complicated.
This is now, by my count, the second or third really bold Ukrainian move in the water over just the last few weeks, the other big one being President Zelensky's visit to Snake Island, which required traversing a number of miles of supposedly Russian Navy-controlled waters. How do you read? I mean, I look at this as the Ukrainians, among other things, just making a statement very loudly about their contempt for Russian naval control over this area. Do you read it the same way, or is it just a coincidence that a few days ago Zelensky is on Snake Island and last night the Ukrainians hit the bridge again?
I think it's probably a coincidence. My assumption is that an operation like this took many weeks, if not months, to plan. So it's been likely in development for quite some time. But this is an operation that follows many operations we have seen from Ukrainians over the last few months, targeting Moscow with drone strikes, targeting even the Kremlin itself with that famous strike of two drones attempting to detonate on the roof of the Kremlin. Some of these attacks are symbolic in nature, showing that, yes, we can reach Moscow, we can strike your most important infrastructure yet again, like this Kerch Bridge. But it does also have the added benefit of significantly increasing the pressure on the regime. This is embarrassing for Putin. He has put so much of his credibility into building this bridge, obviously occupying Crimea and annexing it illegally. And to have it be struck for a second time after assuring everyone that this would not be repeated. And literally a couple of months after the repairs from the first strikes had been completed, they were allegedly completed back in May, is incredibly embarrassing for him. And I'm sure that irritating Putin has people in Kyiv smiling.
Right. So what has Russia said and done in response so far?
Well, they're accusing Ukrainians of conducting, quote unquote, terrorist attack. There are civilian casualties as a result of this attack. There was a civilian vehicle that was on the bridge when it was hit, and apparently a mother and a father of a 14-year-old daughter had been killed, and the daughter itself, who apparently was not wearing a seatbelt, was flew through the windshield and had sustained some injuries as well. So they're calling it a terrorist attack, and in response, they've said they're suspending or terminating their participation in this grain deal that I know we'll be talking about. Although I have to say that I'm quite skeptical that this is in response to the attack, because they've been indicating for many months now that they were going to pull out of this deal once it expires today.
Yeah, so we'll get to the grain deal in a moment. But I assume we should expect some retaliatory strikes that, unlike this one, are not against legitimate targets, right?
Yeah, but, you know, it's not like they've been holding back. They've been striking Kyiv consistently and other cities for months now, really since last year. I was just in Kyiv last week, and there were air raid sirens every single day when I was there. So it's not like they've been holding back, and I think they'll just continue business as usual.
You just beat me to my next question. You were in Kyiv last week. I saw some of your tweets. Tell us about the mood and how things seem to you, particularly relative to your expectations.
So on one hand, it's a very normal city. People are going about their daily lives as you would expect in any European city or even American city. But, you know, you don't have to dig too deep to see the trauma and the pain of this war. Everyone knows people that are fighting, people that have died, people that have been maimed. There are a number of amputees, young men that are on the streets of Kyiv. And one of the scenes that struck me particularly hard, to be honest with you, is when we were leaving from the train station to go back to Poland. And right before we boarded the train, suddenly out of nowhere, there was literally dozens upon dozens of ambulances that just showed up, literally a sea of ambulances, probably a total of 60 to 70 of them. And they were there to pick up the daily wounded that were coming in from the front. And, you know, as you're just looking at them row after row after row of ambulances, you start to get the sense of the real trauma and pain of this war. These are just wounded, of course.
And this is a daily thing.
Daily thing. What struck me in particular, I was talking to folks at the station. They said, you know, today is a pretty good day. It's a relatively small number of ambulances. Just think about that, right? And, you know, we have to say that there are many more wounded than there are killed. And some of the wounded may not be, you know, seriously wounded. They may be able to get back to the front. But nevertheless, you know, it's a daily occurrence, what the Ukrainians are suffering through, what their young generation of men are suffering through, what their families are suffering through. And that trauma, that psychological trauma is very real. And I think will be with the Ukrainians for a very long time. They're, of course, determined to keep on fighting. In part, you know, I think many in the West do not fully appreciate this. The reason for that determination is not just, you know, we're going to take our country back and so forth. That plays into it as well. But in part, it's almost desperation, because they know that Russia won't stop, that Russia and Putin will continue to hit them. And their only choice is to keep on fighting. There is no other choice. There is no talk of negotiations. They kind of scoff at that because they don't think that there's anything to negotiate with Putin about. There's nothing that you can trust that's coming out of his mouth or a piece of paper that he's going to sign his name to. So in the absence of any other options, they just have to keep on fighting. And they're thinking that this may go on for a very, very long time. I think there are many in the West that think that, you know, after this counteroffensive, you know, things will start to simmer down. There'll be some sort of negotiated settlement. And that's just not the feeling there. And I'll just tell you a quick anecdote. The driver that was taking us to the train station, this very young guy, about 25 years old, had just fought on the front, had returned to Kyiv because he had a newborn son. And he, as we were leaving, he said, you know, I hope this war is over before my son grows up. That is how people are thinking about this in Kyiv.
Wow. So let's talk about the counteroffensive briefly. There was some significantly sobering news over the weekend, both about the amount of armor from both the United States and Germany that had been destroyed in the counteroffensive, and about the amount of ground that the Ukrainians have been able to retake of the 60 miles that they would need to take to reach the sea and thus cut off the land bridge to Crimea. Supposedly only five have been had. How do you read this? That, you know, I noticed George Stephanopoulos asking Jake Sullivan based on this, is it a stalemate or a quagmire at this point? It seems like a stupid question, but it does seem to be a fair question to say, is this more of a slog than people expected it to be? And how should we evaluate the counteroffensive to date?
Well, look, I had meetings with various folks in the military, very high-level people, as well as people that have just been at the front while in Kyiv. And I can tell you that they told me openly that things have not gone as fast or as well as they had hoped. They knew this would be hard. They did not expect this to be so tough and for the Russians to be so entrenched there. The minefields are very extensive, very substantial, anti-personnel mines, anti-tank mines everywhere. And the Russians are redeploying them via UAV drones. There are tank traps. There's extensive trenches, a lot of artillery. The rotary aviation, the helicopters of the Russian military are causing them a lot of problems and inflicting serious casualties. They have suffered some vehicle losses early on in the offensive. And because they have so few of them, they're now having to dismount and go on foot into the minefields under Russian fire to clear mines. Obviously, something that's really, really dangerous. And one of the problems, of course, when you go into the minefields on foot is that when you suffer casualties, you have to carry people out on your backs or carrying people. And that's really, really difficult. Again, under fire in minefields. And this is just really, really tough. It's not over. They're continuing to push, but they're paying a high price for every kilometer of territory that they gain. Part of the challenge they're facing is that the brigades that they've sent into this fight are new brigades that were formed specifically for this counteroffensive. They've had some training in the West, but we're talking really about six, in some cases, 8 weeks of training. That's not a lot. And the bigger problem is that they have, most of them have very little combat experience. And where you're sending people, even with training, that have not been in combat, that have not been under fire, that have not seen their buddies die around them into this situation, it's really hard for them to keep going, because that's really the only option. There's no miracle solution here. You know, even if this was the U.S. military that was trying to do this mission under those constraints with no air power, very limited equipment, the only solution is to keep going into the minefield, keep going to the next offensive, even as you're taking these horrific casualties. That's really, really tough for anyone, and especially for people that have never experienced that. So it's continuing. It's probably going to go on for another couple of months, this offensive. The limiting factor for it really is ammunition. So they've procured, or we've been able to procure for them, a significant amount of ammunition from South Korea. And once those stocks are depleted, along with the cluster munitions we've just given them, that's when really they will no longer be able to sustain this counteroffensive. So the hope is that before that happens, probably sometime in late September, they can make progress and get to the Sea of Azov.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20 code LAWFARE20. All right. Speaking of Cs, Mikhaila, Dmitry mentions that with the Kerch Bridge as a pretext, the Russians have now announced that they are not going to renew the Black Sea Grain Initiative. For those who are uninitiated, what is the Black Sea Grain Initiative, and what role has it played over the last 6 to 9 months?
Yeah, sure. So the Black Sea Grain Deal, officially called Black Sea Grain Initiative, was brokered by the United Nations in Turkey back in July 2022, and it helped to resume grain exports and other foodstuff exports from Ukrainian ports to the world. Following Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, the Black Sea Fleet effectively blocked the ports. There were significant risks of amphibious attacks on Odessa, among other things. And Ukrainian self-defense mined approaches to the ports. And under the circumstances, the grain exports were impossible. But with time, Ukraine increased its anti-ship missile capabilities with the help of the Western partners. And as a result, the Black Sea Fleet restrained its operations in the Black Sea. And we can make this conclusion from the famous sinking on the Moscow flagship and then the liberation of the Snake Island, which was also very symbolic for Ukrainians. And this restraint of the activities of the Black Sea Fleet contributed to circumstances where Ukrainians could strike this deal. But there was also a pressure on Russia from the global south, because the Ukrainian grain exports is critical for the global food security in terms of prices, and it's also critical for Ukrainian economy. And so this deal consisted of two parts. The first part was assurances from both Russia and Ukraine that there would be no attacks, but that primarily concerned Russia in practice. There would be no attacks on merchant ships involved in the export of grain from Ukrainian ports. And this was done by establishing a so-called humanitarian corridor, which was protected from military operations when the merchant ships were there. And the joint coordination center, with participation of the parties from of all parties, Turkey, the UN, Ukraine, and Russia, they coordinated the movement of ships. And among other things, they informed about the movement of ships, military authorities of each party, which then made non-objections to their movement. And in such a way, this provided a comfort for the market to resume the operation to Ukrainian ports. That's the first part of the deal. The second part was an agreement, the memorandum of understanding between Russia and the United Nations Secretariat, according to which the United Nations Secretariat team pledged to facilitate the export of Russian foodstuffs and fertilizers to the world markets, basically engaging with Ukraine's Western partners and private companies in order to remove a Russia-alleged limitation of those. Albeit the sanctions, unprecedented sanctions that the much of international community imposed of sanctions largely didn't touch the Russian foodstuff exports, still there were some indirect consequences, which Russia used in order to try to extract some concessions in the sanction regimes. And those effects were basically an overcompliance and self-sanctioning by the private market. Because as bankers noted, their risk appetite was basically reduced to zero. They avoided as far as possible the transactions with Russian element, being afraid to get exposed to penalties or God forbid, secondary sanctions being put themselves on the list of sanctions. And there were also reputational concerns dealing with Russia-related transactions. And so those two parts of the deal played a role because Russia put a condition. Ukraine and Western partners would not agree to easing the sanctions, having a deal with Russia on this. So that basically was done via the UN Secretariat. And it's interesting that the grain deal itself doesn't mention anything about this memorandum of understanding between Russia and the UN Secretariat.
It's kind of just a side deal.
Yeah, it's a side deal. But the grain deal itself is so flexible in terms of terminating it that it allowed Russia to use it to blackmail other counterparts, saying we would not agree to the extension of the deal if there would be no progress with the MOU. And basically what the deal said is it's in force for 120 days, and then it can be automatically extended unless one of the parties expressed intention to terminate it or change it. And so basically that's a veto over the deal extension. And that allowed Russia to politically connect it and try to get concessions.
Yes. So the Russians formally terminated the deal today or last night. And they did it officially in response to the Kerch Bridge attack. But my impression was that the deal had been kind of on its last legs for the last 3 months or so, and it had kind of been living on borrowed time. Is that wrong?
Dmitry correctly mentioned, and that was something that the Kremlin spokesman Peskov mentioned, that the main reason for them not agreeing to the extension of the deal was that their demands in respect of easing the sanctions were not met, not because of the Kerch Bridge strike. And so they were threatening to exit for a long time. So they firstly tried to increase pressure by reducing the time frame of the deal from 120 days to 60, then agreeing the second time for 60 days. And when their threats didn't work, there was only one choice for them, right? Either to act according to those threats or becoming a paper target in terms of completely losing credibility in getting anything from this. But I should say that still, albeit the exit of Russia at this stage is not related to the Kerch Bridge strike itself, but Ukrainian strike is related. And that's an interesting part. And there are reasonable grounds to believe that according to the deal, if you remember in October 2022, when for the first time Ukraine used maritime drones to attack the Black Sea fleet in Sevastopol, Russia immediately suspended the grain deal, saying that accusing Ukraine of using the humanitarian corridor for purposes of military attacks. Ukraine denied everything, but Russia then agreed to re-enter the deal on the condition that such operation would not be repeated in the future. And according to the deal itself, as the Undersecretary General of the UN, Griffith, confirmed, military operations in the humanitarian corridor were prohibited only when the ships were inside the corridor. As long as there were no ships, there was a room to say that you could have used it for the attacks.
So you're saying, in other words, that Russia's departure from the deal frees up Ukraine to engage in attacks like this?
So Russia made a condition that if such attacks would be repeated in the future, they would exit. And we can only speculate about this, but following the extension of the deal in October 2022, for some time, the Ukrainians refrained from similar attacks. So it's ambiguous whether Ukrainians were involved in foil attacks, of course, but still, similar attacks were not happening until March 2023. That's when Russia starting to say that they would agree only to 60 days. So basically, it looks like there is a chance to believe that Ukrainians connected Russians' threats to exit the deal to their attacks. Because otherwise, such attacks would endanger the grain deal itself. But here, the attack happened on the last day, last hours of the grain deal being enforced, when Russia already made clear for everybody that it's exiting.
Right.
And so Ukrainians felt comfortable to do the strike, or if that were Ukrainians, to do the strike because that would not...
Because they were going to lose the deal anyway.
Yeah.
So Dmitry, do you buy it? Was the grain deal protecting the Kerch Bridge for these last 9 months?
I don't think so. I mean, the Ukrainians have struck the bridge in the past, obviously. It's been a high priority target for them. So they knew that at some point the Russians were going to bail out of this deal, as you've just discussed. So I'm not sure that they were waiting for that versus having the right capability and the right opportunity to strike it. It's unknowable, of course, and we may learn about this long after the war is over, but it strikes me that we may have a coincidence here.
All right. So, Mykhailo, how big a deal is the end of the grain deal for Ukraine? This was a bit of an economic lifeline to Ukraine when it was put in place. Agricultural production is a huge part of the Ukrainian economy. What does it do if the Russians are no longer willing to cooperate with the Black Sea grain deal?
Yeah, Benjamin, I will jump right to this question. I just wanted to comment on what Dmitry said. I agree that that's a bit of a speculation, and there are always explanations for this. For example, Ukrainians may have waited for having enough military capabilities to strike to have a right moment. But what makes me think that it is at least a plausible explanation, because there was a pattern. You see Russian actions in October in reaction to the drone strikes, kamikaze drone strikes. Then no drone strikes almost for half a year. Then right after Russia starts threatening that they would extend the deal only for 60 days, you have a couple days later in March, the strike, another strike on the Black Sea fleet by kamikaze drones. Then when Russia again threatening that no, 60 days will be the last day, there is another strike in April. And then there were again no strikes with military drones, and we have the attack with military drones, with kamikaze drones, in the last minutes when it was already known that Russia would exit the deal. So I still think that there may be other explanations. I just think that's, a pattern that we can, think about.
I will say this. On July 9th, there was an attempted strike of the Kerch Bridge with storm shadows that was intercepted by the Russian air defense. So they have been trying to hit it for some time.
Yeah, that's true. But the difference with maritime drones is that Russia accused Ukraine, and that's uncertain whether it happened, that maritime drones departed from Odessa. So when you are attacking the bridge with the explosion in the trap, like it was the first attack on the bridge, or with storm shadows, there is no movements in the, at least alleged movements in the maritime humanitarian corridor. And that's, of course, like it's just a speculation, but still something that is just interesting to think about.
All right. So how big a deal is this for the Ukrainian economy? Have additional provisions been made for the export of grain over land, or is Ukraine back in the situation that it was before the grain initiative was started in the first place?
So basically, before the war, the grain exports accounted for a substantial portion of Ukrainian grain exports. And so that's a really huge blow to the Ukrainian economy. Like before, in 2021, the agricultural sector accounted for around 10% of Ukrainian GDP. And so it's a huge employer, it's a huge taxpayer, and that's a huge export percentage of grain exports. And here it's, and then there are alternatives for Ukraine, but the transportation route, alternative transportation route, via land and also via the Danube River. There are smaller ports out there, but it's a bottleneck. You cannot transport the amount of grain that was transported via the Black Sea via those alternative routes. In his recent interview for African Media Today, President Zelensky noted that Ukraine will try to convince Turkey and the UN to proceed with the deal without Russia. Whether that's possible, that depends on many factors. But one of the main problems would be that the shipping companies and insuring companies may not be ready to take such risks when there are risks of Russian attack, for example, on the Odessa port, right? While still Turkey, in the past, when Russia suspended the deal in October 2022 in reply to the attack on the Black Sea fleet, there was a continuation of shipments for a short period of time. But that was a short period of time, and then Russia again re-entered the deal. And here, some options maybe is that Turkey, in a certain way, put its, you know, and the UN will just take a risk saying, we'll go with the deal. And then it may put Russia in an uncomfortable position, whether they would be ready for informational reasons, etc., to make attacks on merchant ships or on the Odessa port. But still, it's risky for the merchant ships and maybe some support in terms of state-backed guarantees may be needed. Whether that is possible, it's still, you know, up for grabs. But Ukraine is moving in this direction in order to try to understand whether the Black Sea grain shipments are possible without the Russian participation. And it's important to remember that in the past, Putin said that even if they would exit the deal, they would still guarantee the shipments to Turkey, considering how important Turkey for them. But it's unclear whether this promise would be kept right now under the circumstances.
All right. So, Dmitry, wrap us up. What are you looking for in the coming days as you think about the bridge attack, the end of the grain deal, and your recent experiences in Kyiv?
You know, let me change the question a little bit on you, Ben, if you don't mind. And what I'm actually looking at and what the conversation really is in Kyiv that's so different from the conversation here is not about territory, is not about, you know, are they going to take back, you know, this piece of land or that piece of land? That's important, of course. They want to liberate their people. They want to liberate their territory. But the bigger conversation is, how does this war end with durable security for Ukraine, where Russia is not going to come back and attack in 5 years and 10 years? Because they certainly believe, and I think rightly so, that Russia and its imperial ambitions are not going to end with this war. And that's why they've been pushing so hard on NATO, to try to get into NATO, to provide them that durable security and to allow investments to come in to rebuild the country. But I think in the absence of that, and it's pretty clear that at least while this war is going on, NATO membership is off the table, which, by the way, gives Putin a de facto veto over Ukraine's NATO membership because he can just keep the war going and prevent them from joining NATO. What Ukraine needs is its own deterrent capability, conventional deterrent capability. And the one thing that really surprised me on my trip to Kyiv, Ben, is how little of an effort there is to invest in domestic defense production in Ukraine. That there's so much reliance and dependence on Western weapons that they're not really focused on producing their own munitions, their own missiles. You know, they're asking for long-range missiles from the United States, but the reality is that even if we're someday going to relent on attack-ems, they're probably going to come with caveats that you can't use them against Russian territory, which limits their effect for deterrent, right? And if you have a situation in Kyiv where they have their own indigenous supplies of missiles that can reach, let's say, Moscow, and they're shooting a missile into Moscow for every missile that's shot into Kyiv, that might get the Russians to decide to reconsider pretty quickly. And that's what I think they need to start paying attention to, is how do you marshal all their talents and resources, which are numerous, and they have capabilities to develop missiles. They have their own indigenous missiles that they've, of course, developed in the past, the Neptune missile that sank the Moskva cruiser, the Grom and Grom 2 missiles that they've developed. They can do this. I mean, if North Korea can develop missiles, they certainly can. And I think they need to put a much greater effort into building up their defense industrial base, building their own munitions that can keep Russian targets at risk, and ultimately try to get durable security for themselves.
We are going to leave it there. Dmitry Alperovich, Mykhailo Soldatenko, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Hey, folks, we need you to go out on social media and talk about the Lawfare podcast. We need you to rate and review the Lawfare podcast. We need you to bring others into the light about the Lawfare podcast. And we need you to become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.